Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back with you here Thursday, the 29th of April, 2021 on The Punch Out here from Breakthrough News. And don't forget, tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be live at BT Newsroom across all your social media platforms and at YouTube.com/breakthrough news with the Freedom Side. So again, that's tonight at 8. Going to be talking about a lot of things regarding vaccines and much, much more in terms of vaccine apartheid. But here today on The Punch Out, 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least that's when we're starting, whenever you're listening, very happy to have you. But here on the 29th, we are talking about one big issue here today, and that is Joe Biden's American Family Plan, the related American Jobs Plan, basically everything that came with Biden's State of the Union style speech last night. What's in it? Is it enough? Will it even happen? So that's where we're going here today. Well, last night, President Joe Biden spoke to the nation in a State of the Union type speech centered around his recently introduced American Family Plan and in reference to his other broad policy positions of all sorts, but including the previously unveiled American Jobs Plan that was focused around infrastructure, as well as quite a bit as it regards the issue of foreign policy and going against China. There's so many different pieces to that. I really want to just focus here on this issue of the American Family Plan, which is not only the big issue in front of Congress, but is making a lot of waves because it is one of the more ambitious pieces of legislation in some time from the Democrats as it concerns social programs that can help poor, working, and oppressed people. And it clearly reflects the changes in the mood of poor, working, and oppressed people, and many, quite frankly, in the middle class. Classes, that more has to be done by the government in the United States to address the obvious and major challenges to living a decent life in the U.S. for the average working class person, that is. It certainly does warrant some reflection, as many have noted, about why this is happening, because it seems that Biden might even be a little bit more ambitious than what Obama was doing in 2009. And I think it's important to note here that what has really changed since early 2009, and between then and early 2021, in my view, can only be the fact that there's a much larger, much more mature, and much more combative movement for pro-working class changes in the structure of the economy in particular. Evaluating the plan really requires breaking it down in a few ways then. And first, really, of course, is the politics of it all, how to view the various proposals in light of the current political terrain. Can it really happen? And how does that reflect on what was proposed? But after we talk about that, I also want to come back and talk about the overall plan itself. I think it merits a deeper look, the full policies that Biden is proposing, what it really says about our current moment. I mean, what is the content, what it really means? Is it enough? And how should we parse that as a movement that wants to see pro-working class and a pro-oppressed nations policies in the United States? That's certainly how we feel here at Breakthrough News. Now, I said let's start with the politics of it all, because even at first glance, it's clear the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan have almost no chance of passing as they were proposed slash written. Democrats have decided, or at least a majority of them, or enough of them, seem to agree that they will not revise the filibuster rules nor overrule the Senate parliamentarian on budget reconciliation issues. This certainly is the position of the White House about what should happen. And that, of course, puts the Democrats in a strategic bind. It means they can essentially only use their majority to pass bills in a situation where all 50 Democrats support said proposal and that are also within the narrow set of things that can be addressed via budget reconciliation. If it doesn't work like that, they're essentially going to have to find about 10 Republicans to agree with them to pass anything. The real sticking point here in all these different proposals is taxes. Republicans refuse to do anything that raises taxes, even if only on the richest people and only by 1 cent, it seems. It's absurd. And the more conservative Democrats only want to endorse tax rises that would allow for a tiny fraction of either plan to even be possible. And this is certainly where the negotiations stand currently in Congress. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, is discussing a gutted version of both plans with Republicans already, and himself has floated various different things that could be cut from the plan to gut it. The White House, and this one has flown under the radar. Everyone's talking about Joe Manchin, but the White House has already set up a task force working with Republicans on some sort of compromise bill on the American Family Plan issue, but also as it concerns infrastructure. Now, this task force is led by Steve Ricchetti. Now, if you're a regular listener to The Punch Out, you might be thinking, well, wait a second, where have I heard that? Well, recently you heard about it here on The Punch Out because we talked about Steve's brother, who is one of the top corporate lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and interestingly enough, has seen the income of his firm quintuple in quarter one as Biden become president. Now, that can't be because his brother works with the president in the White House. Could it be? Nah. The Republican proposal on infrastructure, which was funded, by the way, this is their proposal with regressive taxation. So they don't want to raise taxes 1 cent on the wealthiest people, but they are willing to raise money where the burden falls on the working class. But that bill was only $200 billion, which is basically nothing from an infrastructure perspective. Biden, who, as we've already talked about, isn't proposing to do as much as needed in a whole other areas, is proposing $1.4 trillion. So while the Republicans haven't offered any counters to the family plan, the discrepancy there in the jobs plan, $200 billion versus $1.4 trillion, gives you a sense of the differences here and the type of massively slimmed down bill or bills that ultimately would pass, if anything passes at all, in terms of what moves forward, addressing only a tiny fraction of what is needed to address critical issues from bridges to access to preschool and affordable childcare. So that's also the context in which we have to view the issues that are emerging around healthcare within the Democratic Party as it concerns the American Family Plan. Now, one of the things that is out here is the need to reduce the overall cost of healthcare for people. And in the fact sheet released by the White House about the American Family Plan, the president, his supporter, his team, whatever, were saying that they supported expanding Medicare by lowering the eligibility age, expanding what's covered, and giving Medicare more power to negotiate drug prices. But they didn't actually include that in the plan itself. They just proposed increasing subsidies for the Affordable Care Act exchange plans. In other words, making healthcare more affordable for average people by giving tons of money to insurance companies, hospitals, and big pharma, rather than expanding public healthcare and the ability of the public sector to negotiate drug prices, which would also bring down the cost of healthcare. So it seems Biden is basically saying he supports in principle the issue of expanding Medicare, but he's not going to fight for it. And they got to just take care of that in Congress. That's certainly he's putting the ball in their court. And indeed, there are some powerful people who support expanding Medicare over the issue of increased subsidies. Now, the reason this is important is because something similar happened with the $15 an hour minimum wage. Biden included it in his relief plan while more or less saying he didn't think it would pass reconciliation muster and refusing to make a big fight for it. But there was a big push by pro-working class forces on Congress to increase the minimum wage that ultimately failed. Now, in retrospect, we also talked about this on the punch out, so go back and listen to your past punch outs to hear more about all of this. In retrospect, it's clear that the White House raised the $15 an hour minimum wage issue as a bit of a smokescreen. Create a big fight over an important issue with little chance of passing, and then when it fails, and the compromises are on the table, the scramble for something rather than nothing, because people are really hurting so badly in this country, so many people, then splinters the pro-working class camp into various interest groups who are fighting for their individual thing that may have gotten funded, and then you can present the final product as better than it really is. It's sort of like, well, you lost the big thing, but you keep some of the little things. So you use the smokescreen issue to make the final retreat much more palatable. And it seems like the same thing is happening here with expanding Medicare. It will draw, rightfully so, quite a bit of energy, righteous anger, and so on. A valiant fight that, when it fails, would make a retreat to a final watered-down bill seem a little more palatable because it feels like you were fighting on this one issue, but it felt like you were fighting for the whole thing to be more progressive. So when the whole thing is less progressive, then it's like, well, at least we put up the good fight. It's the whole point of the smokescreen issue. And it doesn't mean that people shouldn't focus on any one important issue or that you can never compromise in any context. But what it means is the bigger overall issue has to be raised, and that is the impossibility of the thing itself. The fact that without ending the filibuster, there is no way to take away the main institutional leverage of those looking to block seemingly any change to the status quo of even minor significance is the key. Without pressing on that tactical point, it more or less sets up any plan that actually helps people in any way, sets that up for failure, and hands over again the key leverage point to the forces most resistant to any change. And it's this type of fight over whether or not these priorities are important enough to eliminate these made-up Senate rules for that the Biden administration wants to avoid. They don't want to have the argument be over whether or not all of this stuff should be done and more. And the way to limit that is to limit the tactical and strategic space in which the debate can move. So in the same way they use the minimum wage issue, they want to use the Medicare issue to try to shrink the space of the debate and get away from the key point. And it's such a key point because whether or not any of Biden's plans as proposed are either acceptable or what is actually needed is a bit besides the point when the way that he set it up to fight for them seems designed to lead to defeat and much weakened compromise while creating the maximum appearance that they didn't give up before they started and perhaps even that they fought hard for the right thing. So again, the issue isn't so much about whether or not people should ever compromise or whether or not people should support something that is good but not enough. The real issue is, can the fight be conducted in a way to open up more space for improving the possibilities of succeeding at a higher degree rather than close it down? But stepping back a little bit from the on-the-ground issues, there's so much more that can be said about the sort of tactical nature of that, what it means about the Democrats and what it means about our struggle. But I think it means that we should take us one step back here on the other question, recognizing some of those tactical issues is, well, is it enough? Is it what we need? Now, with the American Jobs Plan, that was much more straightforward. Clearly, they are underselling the Biden administration, or they're not underselling, they're overselling it, but they're overselling what they're doing vis-a-vis what's necessary. They aren't putting enough money in, just for example, to rebuild all of America's bridges. So while it wasn't enough, and certainly in many ways wasn't objectionable, even though it wasn't enough, it was not going to meet the scale of the problem. But hey, better to fix a good chunk of the bridges than none at all. No doubt about that, but nevertheless, it wasn't enough. So it was a little bit more of a straightforward piece. And I think when you look at it like that, the American Family Plan is basically in the same ballpark. The reality is, even though many of those receiving help in the plan absolutely deserve more, no doubt about it, the differences would be truly significant for many working class people. For instance, 67% of low-wage workers, 30 million people, do not have access to even one mandated paid sick day. Not even one. Biden's plan would establish, once fully implemented, up to 3 months of paid leave covering no less than 2/3 of your wage. Child care expenses are really just crippling for a huge number of working people. The average American family is spending 10% of their income on child care. That's actually 40% higher than the definition of affordability, according to the government. The Biden plan will put $225 billion into the Child Care Development Block Grant Program and a subsidy program designed to limit the cost of child care to no more than 7% of a family's income. So in other words, that would be a 30% decrease on average in child care costs. Again, a huge impact for people who are not rich. And also, by the way, it would raise the abysmally low wages for childcare workers by setting a minimum at $15 an hour. The plan, it deserves to be mentioned, also ends the ban on formerly incarcerated people applying for food stamps. Incredibly callous, never should have been done in the first place, but a huge change for those who are returning citizens. So again, there is an issue here similar to the American Jobs Plan of whether or not people, the environment, the country, or whatever deserves more. No doubt about it. But it's hard to say this American Family Plan, if fully implemented, more or less paid for fully by taxes on the rich, is objectionable, even though it's not everything. In terms of the concrete impact of the plan, it would obviously be big. Now, where do the various quibbles come in here? And there are some. For instance, the paid leave program will pay not less than 2/3 of your income, but no more than 80%. Now, if the motivation for paid leave is that it's completely logical sometimes people can't come to work, and that they shouldn't lose income due to these very logical reasons, why doesn't the program cover 100% of one's wages? It's a fair point. Or for that matter, if everyone should have access to childcare, why should it not be provided for free as a public good? Clearly the money for that exists, so certainly, fair point to make. But what's the context of the critique? It has to be more than just what's wrong with a proposal like this when honestly, it's not adequate, but it's obviously clearly correct. Undoubtedly, every program that is being increased in this American Family Plan should be increased. In fact, it should be increased more and better. But these aren't exactly minimal changes. They're just not as much or enough as hardworking people really deserve. The real issue to me, the one that has to be grasped and uplifted, is the deeper logic of Biden's plan. Because honestly, political struggle like war requires compromises, retreats, and truces. So you can't just have a default position that things are bad because they didn't go as far or as you like, or they weren't done exactly as you like it. That's just not logical. No social movement of any note, including those with the most radical reputations like the Black Panthers or the Bolsheviks, ever acted that way. In fact, they all pointed out quite sagely at many times that political struggle like war requires compromises, retreats, and truces. So it's really about grasping the deeper level critique of Biden's plan and finding a way to help grasp that real division on what it says and what it means. Because what really is at stake when you look at Biden's plan is who controls society. Well, the cap is at 80% on paid leave because the underlying logic is that regardless of how legitimate the reason, you aren't there, you aren't there. And if you aren't there, the boss shouldn't have to pay you like you were, even if he does have to give you something. Again, the logic of capital. Or take Medicare. Clearly, the more efficient way to provide health care is to make it more of a public good. Expanding Medicare to tens of millions, even if it isn't to everyone, won't end for-profit health care. But it does impinge on the ability of healthcare companies to make profits, and expanding the age downward takes away more of their most profitable customers, senior citizens. So subsidies are totally inefficient. They subsidize a vastly inflated cost of healthcare, but it doesn't challenge the power of the private sector to control healthcare and thus is more palatable to the Joe Manchins of the world. In both cases, it shows the difference between addressing a problem and solving a problem, which speaks to the difference between influence and power. Clearly, mainstream politics is struggling to adapt to growing demands from poor, working, and oppressed people. It has obviously influenced their decisions on a range of issues, from wages to social program funding to police terror. But it hasn't moved either of the two parties any closer to a framework designed to solve these problems at all, specifically because the solutions involve deep modifications to or the outright ending of capitalism. The question for people who want more policies that help poor, working, and oppressed people is how to exploit the influence as far as it goes and how to grow the struggle into a struggle for power. So to move from influencing problems, influencing the issues and in many ways to solving the issues by moving from influence to power. That's the real challenge. And how to do all of that, of course, is a much bigger issue than the discussion here. But I wanted to raise that issue directly to say that it's not going to happen from just some random critique of Biden for not being someone who he clearly is not. He clearly is not someone proposing transformational change. That's not who he is. And even when he tries to present himself that way, it's ultimately not that believable. The challenge is that we have to find a way to soberly identify what's needed, what's on offer, in what venue, and how concretely collective action can move forward towards transformational change, which will involve small and large incomplete victories, and how to do that without being sidelined or co-opted by those who don't want to go that far. I mean, it's a huge task. But as all this really goes to show, the need is too great not to embrace it, not to embrace the task of really making transformational change rather than simply denouncing those who are in positions of power who refuse to push that far. The point isn't just to interpret the world, it's to change it. And that is going to do it for us here today on the Punch Out 429-2021 tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern on Breakthrough News here at BT Newsroom on all your social media platforms, youtube.com/breakthroughnews. We will be live with the Freedom Side talking about vaccine apartheid amongst many, many other issues. And we'll be back with you tomorrow on the Punch Out here from Breakthrough News.